the goddess is the one that saves him. Lakshmi, who's devoted partner, places her hand at his throat and stops the progress of the poison and holds it there in place and prevents Shiva from killing him. So it's just that's one of the pictures
Laying your way here, I can move.
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna use this most of the time. There's another one here that I just particularly like this one. And then we're about to get ready to start, right?
Yeah.
Okay. This is one of my favorite ones, and I wanna point it out here. This is fairly modern, but it's a little more modern expression, I think, of an idea that really pervades Shaivism, which is, I was just talking about, is that Shiva is you. It's the practitioner. Male, female, there's a lot of androgynous Shivas, and this is why. Because it's not someone else, that it's not a parent that you're appealing to. It's the aspiration of the yogi or the yogini to this perfected state of realization in which you realize, oh yeah, not only do you realize your true self, but you also, as the Upanishads say, Atman, true self, is Brahman, is God. So you realize true self, remember that. Oh, right, I forgot, I knew that. I am, in fact, God, that realization, oh, and then after that, that's not the end of it. After that, oh, by the way, so are all these people, so is the whole world, so forth, so there's this progression. But it's very much, this is Shiva. It's not Lakshmi, it's not Shiva's wife, it's not Shakti, it's Shiva. At first, I was really sure it was female. I'm not sure it is. I think that's my Western. You know, I see the hips and I see the round face, and that, you know, those could be ideals of male beauty in some cultures too. So I'm not so sure, but I like that quality about it because that makes true. Do what the whole should be the whole of the law.
Love is law, love under will.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm just gonna scroll this ahead a little bit and leave it. So, this is a little bit about my story and my involvement with Tantra and my journey with it and experiences with it. And on one hand, to share with you what I've been doing and so forth. But also, this has led me to look at connections between Tantra and Thelema. Not historically, because as we were saying, discussing, I'm not sure there's too many of them. There may be some. The thing is, I'm not really into Hinduism. I don't really get into it. Not like the culture is beautiful. Food, the art, culture, it's such beautiful. A lot of beautiful cultures. I don't feel like, oh, that's my... I mean, I do feel that when I'm in some places. Some places you go like, wow. Wow, this is like my old neighborhood, you know, or something like that. I don't really get that, per se, with most of Hinduism. So I am not approaching this as somebody who is going native, as it were, who is embracing that. And I have with some other things. I remember really getting into ancient Egyptian art, painting a lot of it, painting my walls, and doing all this stuff, and really, really living it, and then other things and other cultures and so forth. That's not where I'm at with this, really at all. And some beautiful pictures. 30 years ago, as you know, I joined OTO and I had been learning about ceremonial magic. 30 years ago also, I was initiated into a tantric meditation practice. A friend of mine knew how to do it. Hey, you want to learn how to meditate? Cool. Hey, yeah, you know, give me two. You know, I'll try anything. You know, I was trying everything. I was learning about all kinds of different Western as well as Eastern, right, traditions. And I was a college student at the time, and I happened to be at a university that had a really robust religious studies department. And so I was able to study with some really heavy people, they're both in Western religion a little bit, and then Eastern religion, and make some connections there. So my original connection was, I mean, the books are here, really. I mean, I was your typical Western occultist. I'm getting all the books I can, I'm figuring out what the heck is going on, and what are all these different world traditions? And I was trying to do kind of my own do-it-yourself comparative
religion, mysticism path, as we do. And back in the day when you had to buy books to do it. So I was initiated into a meditation practice. It was great. And I did not realize what I had. Did not realize the depth and power of what I had learned. And 30 years later, it's evolved, it's changed, but holy crap, I'm doing it. Okay. I love it. So, you know, on one hand it's my little, you know, what I've been doing on the side, oh by the way, hey, this is pretty cool, you might like it too. But some stuff has really happened for me that I think, you know, it's all this Saturn return timing, right? I was astonished when I started getting results. And without really going into the details of those results right now, when you get results, when you get really strong personal results, you know, one of the first questions is, what the fuck? What is this? Am I kidding myself? Is this what it looks like? And then you spend, you know, a year or so, like, doubting it and testing it any way you think as far as what you're doing. But then at a certain point, you also start asking, okay, all right, so I'm getting the idea that is what I think it is. What the hell? Why am I doing a bunch of Eastern practices and getting a profoundly Western result? Did I program myself and now it's popping up? Didn't seem like that accounted for. Or does that Easter stuff relate? Is it connected to the work that we do as magicians, the way we formulate the great work, knowledge and conversation, aspiration, realization, all that stuff? How does that relate? Well, obviously Crowley was hugely influenced by Eastern religion, certainly by Hinduism, Buddhism as well. So it's not a stretch. They do relate. So I started really studying the texts. And when I did that, because in 30 years I didn't. Honestly, 30 years, I just did my practices, right? I took some initiations and got some stronger practices. But I really didn't look under the rocks and see what's going on. Why is there this stuff? That's wrong. Oh, it just timed out. That's actually probably a good time. Let's see.
I'll do that. Nice. Okay. A video clip I'd like to play this video later on. Let's just look at it.
Fun with religious, like me. So, I'm a white boy. I'm not claiming to not be a white boy. I have some understanding of cultural appropriation. That's not what I'm trying to do. One of the most useful concepts that I learned in religious studies, and this is important because I am approaching this, yeah, as a ceremonial magician, yeah, somebody who does the practices, but also I had this early on training in the academic scholarly study of how do you look at religions and how do you examine these in a rigorous and scholarly way while realizing you're dealing with something that's intensely personal, intensely subjective, and can be intensely cultural. And how do you do that justice? And it's tremendously easy if you say, well, we'll just do it from the inside, and then it's no problem. We're just us, and you know, we're Christians in a Christian school, or Thelemites in a Thelemic school, or whatever. How do you look at the others? So one of the key concepts that I learned, and I'm sure you've heard very much more detail than I've got as an undergrad, I was a religion minor. At the time, I was an art student, started physics. I was an art student. But back in those days, you had a major and a minor, and my minor was religious studies. And so I got to take all these you know, core classes. One of the key concepts is the difference between emic and etic knowledge. Okay? You've heard these words before. Emic knowledge is knowledge that you know as a member of the group. Right? If you're a Christian and you've been saved, you know you're saved, and you know what that means as a member of that group. I am not a Christian. I don't know what's going on with your soul. I don't even know what your soul is. Now, if I were part of your group, then that would have meaning to me. However, on the outside, all I can do as a scholar is say, okay, in this religion, they do this thing, and then they have this thing, they said they're saved. They believe they're saved. As a scholar, I can say that empirically, that these people do this certain thing and think this certain thing about it. Is it true? That's another question. that truth, that is emic knowledge. You know, is their religion true or false? As scholars, that's not what we're here to make that evaluation. Who are we to take on that role? Okay. Now, so etic knowledge is knowledge that is empirical, that is objective. You can say, hey, they wore these color robes and they did this thing and they said this about it. Emic knowledge is, I've now bar mitzvahed, suddenly I'm a new person in this new world in this way. If I'm not Jewish, you know what? I'm no amount of explaining is going to explain what being bar mitzvah is. Just like if you're not an OTO member, no amount of explaining will tell what it means to take a degree. That's just how it is. There's an insider knowledge, and that has to be respected. However, that doesn't mean we throw up our hands and say we can't study it. Okay? A classic example of doing this wrong is actually when the Catholics invaded Central America and studied the Aztecs. And they had just enough clue to realize that the Aztecs' human sacrifice, that blood sacrifice was equivalent to the sacrifice of the Mass. It was the body of God. There was an equivalence going on there. They were just smart enough to see that rather than just so going, ew, that's weird, I don't understand it. They went, oh! But then here's the problem. They said, their ceremony, their religion, is just a primitive subset version of this thing that is our religion, which is the true religion. They're a primitive version of God. Isn't that cool? Even the primitives begin to understand intuitively the correct knowledge of God. Now, they're like pretty close to coming up with an anthropologically profound idea about, hey, these primitive cultures have gnosis, right? But they didn't get that far. They said, okay, yeah, we see it. We're going to keep it in a box and interpret it inside our own world. This is like being a member of a Christianity and judging whether everyone is saved or not. And a lot of cultures are smart enough not to do this. You know, Jews realize that if you're not Jewish, you don't care about kosher. Fine, they don't have a problem with that. That's their problem, that's not your problem. That's their emic understanding of why that's important. So understanding emic and etic is really important. There's another thing that I want to ask you to do as I'm going through here, because we're going to get into some territory where, holy crap, there's some correspondences to some things in the Book of the Law, to some things in the text. I mean, you know, wow. And yet, please reserve judgment. I had to make myself do this really, really strongly. I did not jump to conclusions and say, oh, this is the same as that. I have some theories that some things are the same, but I'm going to be very, very cautious about that. I'm going to tell you where they are. In particular, In particularly, don't try to stick stuff in 777 columns, right? Because there's a whole structure there that presumes, for one thing, there are some things that kind of correspond to Kabbalah, and they don't fit. Especially the supernals don't fit. There's a bunch of stuff in Tantra that is just, well, okay, where's you guys? Okay, you guys don't have that either. So Tantra has a critique of other religions. Oh, the emic. I'm getting ahead to all these exciting topics. One of the interesting things about emic and etic with the Tantras is that the texts actually almost anticipate this. The sacred texts, these 10th and 12th century texts, are saying, a bit of a group is saying basically, correct interpretation of the sacred text does not come through religious authority, and it does not come through social understanding or social status or social participation. It only comes through having done the practices. It says anybody who does the practices, regardless of who they are, or where they're from, where or when or how or what, if you do the practices, then you are a member of the people that we are talking to as people who are interpreting the text and experience. In other words, you're a practitioner. What I found was that there's this amazing body of knowledge written between the 8th and 12th century that's very technical about consciousness and yoga and meditation and how to do it and how it works, and it is very free of religion. It's free of much in the way of ethics and morals, doesn't really deal with it. It's pretty much technical Gnostic information. It's very much along the spirit of do certain things happen. Shiva is treated as, you know, kind of like Smokey the Bear shows up for a little soundbite to have a little dialogue for the sake of the story. But really, you know, you're Shiva. That's your own. So anyway, so that's some interesting stuff.
I think I'm happier standing here.
So you know how there's sometimes little simple things, and if you didn't know what they meant, you think, oh, okay. Horus takes a seat in the east at the equinox of the gods. Oh, okay. Great. That's Horus. He's like a god form. And now we're saying, okay, now he's in the east. Okay. I follow this ritual. Well, what does that mean to a Thelemite? It means revolution. Right? I mean, in a sense, you understand that, yeah, Horus is now the lord of the Aeon. Things are going to change. You see, I'm speaking as a Thelemite to Thelemites. Right? As Thelemites, we know that in that little bit of information is encoded something that says revolutionary things about how we are going to go proceed successfully and get along and do our wills, right? And it's encoded in that little bit of... There's a similar thing that is coming, that is bubbling up with regard to meditation and yoga practices. And scholars see it, and the leaders see it, and I'll be really honest, most people are really hesitant to bring it up in the yoga community because it's revolutionary in a similar way, and it's also tremendously critical, and it also says a bunch of the practices that you've been teaching people actually are harmful for you. Oddly enough. Now, here I'm white boy saying this stuff. So what are we going to do? So I saw that some years ago and went, wow, okay. Householders versus renunciates. Huh. Okay. Didn't realize they were that split. I'll explain what that means in a minute. Okay. But now I'm seeing it in other areas. Other scholarly approaches to this are seeing the same things. I can talk about there's this cultural split. There's this cultural war that has defined the course of human culture for the last 10,000 years. And if you've ever seen a 50s Western, you already know all about it. It's the ranchers and the cattlemen, right? It's the rancher, the farmers and the ranchers. Right? It's not, you know, the plot of all the great cowboy movies. Right? Times are changing, right? In some of the anthropological studies, I think they're calling it the two worlds theory, that there are these two worlds. It also relates to why there was this sudden crash where all these Mesopotamia, all these Mediterranean cultures, these palace economies crashed when it was the year 12. There was a period where all these
event.
Yeah, there's like big, yeah. They like all crashed all at once, and we don't know why. Well, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This way. Right. So there's a clash between what's called the Upper Neolithic and the Lower Neolithic, and I want to get into this first because this sets up the context of everything that's to follow. This explains why you'd want to do some things and not other things. Okay. The Lower Neolithic is a pastoral. It's raising animals, or maybe fruit trees, but usually animals. Right? Goats, pigs, horses, sheep, cows, whatever. Upper Neolithic is plant agriculture. It's agrarian, right? And it's not that it's a plant, it's that you've got big monocrops, you've got grains. And I'm just going to cut to the chase because you're Thelemites. Lower Neolithic animal husbandry, that's the Aeon of Isis. And it isn't as significant that they were worshiping a mother goddess because it's not in all cases they were. But their economy was based on raising animals. Anybody ever raise animals or goldfish? Even houseplants. So if your wealth is measured in your goldfish or your houseplants or your goats, whatever, how do you get more wealthy? Make babies, make the moms happy. They aren't necessarily in charge, but they're the ones that have got to be happy in order to, you know what I'm saying? I mean, this is a basic farming knowledge. If you have horses and you want more horses, what are you going to do? How do you get more horses? Where does wealth come from? Now, when you switch to an agrarian culture, right, wealth becomes a crop. It also becomes something that's not perishable. Right? We which means it's much, much more robust. One of the reasons that the older cultures died off somewhat is, for one thing, you don't make as much money. You just basically don't make as much money in the economy farming animals as you do farming big crops of land. Generally, cultures are more wealthy when they're doing it. But there's another thing that happens. Along with the change in ways of making a living, Joseph Campbell would say, come new myths, right? But one of the reasons the new myths come along is that there's an entirely new dynamic about how it works. Because look at the economy of raising animals. Okay, we're talking about a tribal culture. It's based around either a family or an extended family, a particular farm, tribal groups, extended family kind of groups. Okay. Now, let's say you get a new couple, right, who are going to start their own family. What do? Everybody give them a goat. Everybody get together, we have a big party. Everybody give them an animal. Hey, now they got 50 animals. Start their own farm, they're ready to go. Okay, very easy to do. God, we love those kids. They're going to be so great, right? Very easy to give them all. Everybody give them a little bit, you know. Or even if it's fruit trees, we all give them a fruit tree. Right? Now, here's the problem. Let's say you're raising barley. And you've got no written language, and you've got no math, and you've got no surveying skills. How's everybody going to give the new family a little tenth of a section of land when you can't even measure the land? Okay. So what the non-religious studies, the anthropology, and some of these other studies are telling us now, and by the way, the book that reference books all the way through, the book that's on this is called The Origins of Yoga and Tantra. It really talks about the split between these two kinds of cultures, and particularly goes into what the different spiritual formula is, which I'm about to get to. But this is the reference. This is Jeffrey Samuels, Cambridge University Press, so that's not just some fly-by-night guy. Cambridge thinks he's already. But anyway, so the problem is, as soon as your economy is based on big fields, you naturally evolve a separate class structure of the people working the land and the people who own the land. Okay? And this is not to go off into any particular modern political views of whether that looks like socialism or this or that. I mean, I think those aren't good comparisons to make. I think when you look at that, you have to look at not only the organization, but the family. A lot of very capitalist families are very socialist. When you get into the family and privileges, who gets what privileges for what relationship. It's an odd thing that happens. So I know it looks like that. I don't want to go there. But suffice to say, from a scholarly basis, we can now say with authority, every time the major economic basis moves to propagation of crops, you evolve naturally a separate landowning that isn't the family, and it isn't people who have anything to do with running the class. You have a landowning king, right, or emperor. Right? And with them always comes a new class of person who is called a priest. And the role, and they're very different from a shaman. Now, shamans have been around since time immemorial, right? The difference is shamans, and we know this on a scholarly basis, this is not what the traditions tell us, but we know as scientists, we could say with certainty that all shamans have a day job. And you might pay them to do your exorcism or your wedding or whatever it is, but in all cases, they all fish or hunt or trade beads or do something. They're not getting their entire economy. That just doesn't happen, except in very, very rare circumstances. Sounds a little bit like being a rock musician, right? In most cases. Or a writer or a novelist. How many novelists support themselves? You know, there's J.K. Rowling's and then, right, the other 99% are being supported by somebody. We don't talk about that. Right? Many creative people are very privileged. I've been very privileged to be able to do some things because some family members support. This is how it goes. So the priesthood naturally evolves, and the first job of the priesthood is not to care for the people. The first job of the priesthood is to anoint the king to say that God says that they should be king, and this reinforces the social class. Okay. In return for which, then they get tithing. Right? They get tax money because, oh, by the way, you've got this class structure, now you've got taxation. So in every case, from a scholarly standpoint, in every case, when you see the priesthood arises because of taxes. If There are no taxes. There's no priests. Because who's going to pay them to do nothing but religion all day? Nobody. Right? That just doesn't happen in the economy. Most of the time. Yeah, a few fortune tellers. Good business. Right? But most of the time, the priests, if they didn't have the taxes, they wouldn't be there. Then with the taxation, then you also get this new establishment of an institution that we know as monasticism. That is, you have monasteries, you have monks or nuns, you have people who do nothing but religion and deal with religion all day. Okay? Now, that's not to say that there were not shaman who did that, right? But largely they had their role as, you know, they were sort of beggars on the periphery of the village kind of thing. You know, the Upanishadic sages and so forth. Yes, there have been people who are doing their spirituality full time, yes. But the institutional monasticism supported by taxes is exclusively an Upper Neolithic, plant agriculture-based system. It says science now, it appears. A lot of this stuff has come up in the last 10 years. So there's a bunch of information that we sort of thought we knew about how these religions worked, and now we're starting to say, you know what? Some of these people's stories about themselves don't always match what really happened. I don't know if I said this before we got started, but I'll say it again. One of the very common sort of revisionary stories we get about Hinduism is this trinity of Ramana, the creator, and Vishnu, the maintainer, and Shiva, the destroyer. And that's bullshit. That's later revisionism. That's a Vaishnava. That's a Vaishnava. That's like saying, oh, Christianity and Islam and Judaism, they are aspects, they are three lobes of God's one true religion, you know, which, I mean, there's no Muslim or Jew in the Christian world that's going to agree with that. Like, no, we're fine. We're fine over here. We're our own thing. We don't need those other guys. Yeah, there's some other wacky branches of the family tree. They're fine, right? But don't go around saying, oh, I know what you are. You are a subset of this other thing that I'm inventing. That it's like, okay. So as scholars, we can say we see these patterns between these things. We can say that we see the roots between these things, but that sort of interpretive thing. That's what went on with Shaivism. And why I'm saying this is, Shaivism is the one that comes from the Anne of Isis. That comes from the animal raising, animal husbandry culture. All the other major Hindu forms, Indra and Vishnu and Brahman and on and so forth, they are all Upper Neolithic. They're all law and order, right? Shiva is back from the ages of witchcraft. And interestingly enough, if you look at this division, so this is where, for me, my head started exploding and the light bulbs start going off, because I start realizing, oh, thank you. I start realizing this division between East and West is about as clear as south of the border. Oh, what border is that? Are we talking about paper bags here? Are we talking about you're not white enough? Right? Effectively, East-West is just a way of saying we're over here in the West, and some of those people are just not white enough, and they get different. They get different and mysterious. It's like me as a white person saying, I don't even know what goes on in Central America. It's just a bunch of, people of a different color than me. You know, I can't understand. They're just crazy animals over there. Well, there's not a boundary of where they turn into crazy animals. If it is, it's probably somewhere in America. Right? So in the same way, I stopped thinking that there really is an East and the West. Yes, there are some cultural polarities. But many of these real strong characteristics that we see of Eastern religion, Western religion, have more to do with the layers they come from. If you look at the different places, all the magical practices come from the lower layer, from the Isis layer, witchcraft. They all do. This is why Christianity turns to Kabbalah, turns to Jewish magic, right? Or Greek magic, right? This is why Buddhists and Vaishnavites all adopt tantric meditation practices. Why is that? Well, a couple of things. The tantric practices said, oh, by the way, you don't have to be celibate to get enlightened. Guess what? That was popular. Hey, we've got these new yoga practices. You can be a priest and you can get married. Cool. So, hey, that was really popular. That's one of the reasons why tantra was adopted into so many other traditions. Another being the fact that the texts themselves really don't talk much about any doctrine whatsoever. They'll talk about Shiva as sort of a code word for like what you're aiming to do, sort of like we talk about the great work. But that's very easy to say, oh yeah, you know, us Vishnu worshippers, when they say Shiva, we know it really means Vishnu. Okay, great, done. Now we just use all their stuff. A very great majority of the powerful yoga practices that were then used by the upper Hindu, the Vaishnavite, right, come from Tantra. Because the other reason is they are so much more powerful. You understand why, and this is where I love talking to magicians, because you'll understand how the symbolic formula, the magical formula, influences this. If you are, again, if you are raising animals, how do you get more wealth? You make them happy, right? You increase their, you know, gung-ho, you make them happy, you have throw a party and have festivals and have them fall in love and, you know, feed them good food and, you know, sweet wines that fall in love. Right? So what do you do if you're raising plants? How do you get more wealth? First of all, you chop down, right? You sacrifice, right, seed. And then you take the seed and you sacrifice it again to save some of it for next year. You don't even just eat it. You got to sacrifice. It's all sacrifice. There's nothing about, oh, hey, let's make the seed have a stronger growth rate. That isn't happening, right? There's no genetics to do that, right? There might be some horticulture of, yeah, we'll have better, you know, we'll till the ground better. But by and large, the only thing you can do, it's all sacrifice. And again, in the Samuel's book, he basically outlines this cultural split and says that the lower animal raising formula is sexual, and that the upper is sacrifice of sexuality, particularly male sexuality, because almost in every case, a female sexuality is marginalized. And women are marginalized. It's all about the boys, and we'll sacrifice them. So this image of the young, virile, self-sacrificing, you know, Olympic athlete who, you know, goes through all these hardships and sufferings. Oh, we love that guy. He's our hero. And that's that image of that. Shiva's just the opposite of that. He's the great mystic who's also the giantest party guy who comes down from the mountain off of a giant bender. You know, so it's exactly really the opposite formulas. Problem is that renunciate formula works only if you're a renunciate. It doesn't work for householders. This is where in practice it becomes a problem. And the discrete way that it's talked about in the yoga community is renunciant practice versus householder practice. Right? Renunciant practice also has to do a lot with dualism or monism that says, I want to escape, I want to go with God, I want to get away from this unclean, impure world, and I want to go and become, you know, go with good, pure, divine stuff, right? And Tantra doesn't say that. Tantra says, we'll take a refreshing dip into unity and then come back, because we always do. And when we come back, there's cats to feed, families to take care of, work to do, taxes to take care of, art to do, community to build. And as I do that, I'm going to take that experience of unity and integrate it into what I'm doing. Okay? And this is the image of dancing Shiva, right? If you grab a picture of dancing Shiva. There's a detail at the bottom that you'll see. Let's see, where's a good Shiva? Where he's dancing. There's one. I don't know if you can see at the bottom. There's a figure at the bottom, right? I forget the name of that guy. But that is a dwarf. It's a demon. It's the demon of forgetfulness. And the whole idea is that Shiva is eternal universal consciousness, but Shiva, for the joy of the game, forgets on purpose, and then is divided into individual consciousness. Why? Because Shiva knows that the return to the, oh right, universal consciousness is so sweet that it's worth it. And so there's this is the dance of Shiva, of separation and unity, and separation and unity. Why? Because it's fun. Right. So that's a very lower Neolithic. I mean, more fun. Very lower Neolithic culture. Okay. Let me get a little bit into the text here. So between the 8th and 12th century, there were a bunch of really amazing books that were put out, and I've got a reading list here. I'm gonna give you that. And then we'll get into some of the pass that if you would. We'll get into all that stuff. But let me just touch on what some of these books are. So historically, some of the books that you should know, and a couple of these, the ones at the beginning, are just ones you probably already heard of, Rig Veda, Chorus of Punishments. These are, I'm not even suggesting that you get a copy, meaning Rig Veda is huge. The Vedas are huge as a collection. There's a couple of other texts you should know about that a lot of people don't know. Atharva Veda is the equivalent of the Rig Veda, but it's not in Sanskrit, and it's all the lower class stuff. So it's all the stuff about the goddess, and it's all the stuff about Shiva and all the lore. So it's basically Vedic period, but it is all the magical stuff. It's not unlike, you've seen the Greco-Roman papyri, the demonic papyri, right? It's much like this, because assemblage of all this different, you know, magical spells and cursing your neighbor and love spells, just all this wacky stuff. It just, if you get the idea from the Vedas that the Vedas are all, you know, Vedas are all this high and pure lofty stuff, well, here's the lower class stuff. Yoga Sutras, if you don't know the Yoga Sutras, you definitely should. Fantastic classic on Patanjali's eight limbs of yoga. Right? Tantric yoga, or tantric meditation, would be considered samadhi yoga from that standpoint. The third chapter is important in here too, as magicians, because there's an exhaustive list of the different types of spiritual powers and magical powers that are accessible once you're able to access samadhi regularly. There's this huge split between the writing, and it shows up a little bit in here where they say, don't do this magic because it will lead you astray, it will lead you off the path, but we're going to tell you what it is and how to do it anyway, but don't do it, but here's how to do it, but don't do it, right? Why would they do that? Here's the reason why. There's a split between in the lower and the upper, again, the lower Isis than the upper Osiris, right? Horus is us, frankly, and something that's happening now. I mean, we'll get to that later. But basically, the tantric idea is abundance thinking. You didn't have as much samadhi as you want. It's like sex. It's just how much, within the limits of your physical form and ability, how much do you want? How much bliss can you handle? How much bliss do you want to unload? Unleash, right? Whereas the renunciant idea is, no, you have to sit there and sacrifice everything and be quiet, and you may get it's very, 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 very dry and long way because there's not powerful practice. Now it might be the time to talk about the, we'll kind of get back to it. There's a fundamental idea with Tantra that they have technology that the other, that the Assyrians don't. If you have that technology, you have as much samadhi as you want. But if you don't, if you have to get your ecstasy and your bliss from holding very, 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 very still and being very, very, very good and very, very quiet and nothing else, and then you start to get some energy, if you turn around and use that energy to create miracles or save somebody or bless the brother or whatever, you better be really careful because as magicians we know what's going to happen. You ground your energy out, right? You come back to the real world, you get all charged up, but if you don't know how to invoke powerfully, do some magic and you're back feet on the ground. So to the people who are scarcity thinking in their yoga, then don't do the magic because it's very, very, very wasteful of energy because we don't have much to go around. And the Tantra says, how much do you want? Here's as much as you can carry. It becomes a matter of becoming strong so you can carry away more and do more with it, but there's not that scarcity thing. So that's important. The Yoga Sutras are considered a tantra by the sages, even though they're clearly much earlier. Probably even right around, there's a area of the world, probably slightly before, slightly after year zero. Okay, other texts. Let me get through this really quickly. Kind of in historical order. There's an interesting text called the Shiva Sutras that showed up in the 8th century, and this is a received text. The word for that is Agama. Not unlike the Book of the Law, let's just say. And has a great dramatic story where the mystic has his trance and is told in the trance, go in the river and turn the rocks over. And He goes in the river the next day and turns the rocks over, and the text is carved into the bottom of the rocks. Right? Wow. Of course, those rocks don't exist today. Is this a myth? Probably. What the heck is this about? We don't know. We don't know, but this text appeared with that story, and it's all about practice. It's about the classes of practice, which we'll talk about a little later, body supported and mind supported and unsupported. But it's an essay on these practices. I'm going to leave a copy of this. It's also published under this title, Aphorisms of Shiva. And I'm going to leave a copy of this with the library. About the same time, there's another text here. I should mention Rudra Yamala. Rudra Yamala is sort of a mythical, it's not quite a Necronomicon. It probably did exist, but it's been lost. Probably some of these other books, the Shiva Sutra and this one, are probably big chunks of it. Okay, so there's this thing you hear referenced with Rudra Yamala. It's gone. There is a book published under that name that is shown to be, it's not it. It's another text. It's interesting, but it isn't. It isn't that. It's another text. That's this is called Vijnana Bhairava, the lightning bolt of universal consciousness, right? Published under a great title, Yoga of the Light, Wonder, Astonishment. This is a remarkable catalog of 112 practices, including ones from their own tradition, ones from others' traditions. It has things like, oh, by the way, did you know you can reach enlightenment through compassion? Oh, try it. You know, so you go through things like, oh, that's these people, that's what they're doing. And like, I don't want to say, okay, Mahayana Buddhism got that from Tantra, but holy smokes, there's a lot of interesting stuff. They were certainly gathering from everywhere. Now, the thing is, this book is misunderstood because this is not a recipe book. This is not an instruction manual. This is actually a guide for teachers. And there are a section of it, about a quarter of it, are beginning practices, and that's, what did I mention? I'm writing a book. I have a book on meditation. Some of you have seen some of the manuscripts. And the practices are drawn from this book. Right? But here's the problem. The advanced practices in here, if you go and do them, they don't work. Because the act of doing them prevents them from working. How does that sound for magical, right? Okay, but look at it this way. Suppose I said, all right, so for this ritual that you're going to do, you need to be surprised. Now, quick, go out and be surprised. Really, holy, wow. You can't just say, I'm going to go be surprised. I'm going to go fall in love. Here I go. It's not going to happen. If you do try to do that, it'll probably get in the way of actually that happening. And yet, can you go out there and be surprised? Oh, yeah. The texts talk about suddenly turning a corner, seeing a far-off mountain, Mount Rainier. You turn that corner and go, wow, right? You didn't see it coming, and then there's this moment, and the text says, that is an on-ramp. Seize that moment and go into that feeling, basically, and that becomes an on-ramp. As you do practices and get to more advanced practices, these become very, very powerful on-ramps. Even for a beginner, even for someone who doesn't meditate, you see the mountain, you've got that moment, you see puppies, aww, right? That moment of bliss, that moment of affection, that moment of having your heart move is a means, a way. And so this kind of book has a number of things that are like that, some of them I discovered later on. I wrote a book on this. It's a guide to this. It's a guide to the different classes. Give you guys copies of it. Some of the practices, like I read it, I studied it, it's like, oh, that's interesting. And then later on in my own practice, I'm going along, like, wait a minute. That's what that is. Oh, that means I can do this. And then, you're there. So in a way, it's sort of like a field guide. You can't necessarily go out and say, I'm going to see a Western egret. But dang, if you see when you go, oh, so that means. So that's what this book is about. Really remarkable book. This is, to my mind, one of the most remarkable books ever. Very easily accessible. Other interesting ones. Tantra Loka. I brought these, and you guys are welcome to look through them. This is a 37-chapter encyclopedia on Tantra by the leading sage, 12th century sage of Vinayagupta. Holy crap. The guy is funny. The guy is a wit. It's like reading you know, where he's got a sense of humor about what he's writing, right? And the interesting thing was there was at, this is a time when Tunter was debated in the courtroom in royal court. Northern India was up in the mountains. Nobody wanted to invade it. Relatively safe. It was a place where these different people could come through from different places. Buddhists, and Vaishnavites, and Shaivites would come all and come and debate philosophy. So this book comes out of that and has some very articulate critiques of the other philosophy. I won't get into Trika is the Tantric philosopher. It's philosophy. It's huge. It's not really my thing, but I will refer to it. It's there. There's two books that are here if you want to get into Trika. Trident of Wisdom is an important one, and Doctrine of Recognition. One of the ideas is that one of the most profound magical emotions is the recognition one that we have with experiences we have with people. Oh, you. Oh, that recognition. Or you do a tarot reading, and the cards come up, or the I Ching reading, and karma, and you go, oh, right. Yeah, I knew that. Right? And it's that recognition, that emotion that is. Tantra Loka is hard to get. I should also say, one of the things about Tantra Loka is it's hard as a book buyer because there's two different editions of it by different translators, by the same publishing company, with the same color cover and the same font, and the difference is the particular words and the colored picture, which you see is not the same on any two of them anyway. So, you know, it's like, well, okay, I found volume two, now I'm looking for volume four, and you get volume four, I was like, the numbers don't have the paper, it doesn't even get it. So just so you know, and I've noted that in the reading list, the Singh, Singh translation is the one. This is another book that is related to Tantra Loka in the sense that it's kind of a one-volume Reader's Digest version of Tantra Loka. Oh, master, you've written so voluminously that we could barely even deal with this massive, you know, multi-volume thing you wrote. Can you just put it in one volume? It's like, oh, good, good, all right, good. So that's what it is. It's so close that it's misleading in the sense that there's almost the same number of chapters, but not quite. You know, so it's close. Anyway, but also this is a great way to approach Tantra Loka because as you're interested in some of the subjects, like initiation or whatever it may be, this you can dive into them here and then go to the corresponding section of Tantra Loka and be able to deal with the greater volume. Just a couple more texts, I'll say what they are, and then I'll tell you a little about Trika, and then we'll change things up. So here are some modern scholarly books if you're interested in studying more. Tantra in Practice is by David Gordon White, is Princeton Press, and it's a bunch of essays on different aspects of what actually gets done, all the different branches. Auspicious Wisdom is a very scholarly treatment of the Southern Wisdom Cults. Roots of Tantra is a faz, again, another set of essays that are useful as far as creation grounds. What are they doing in there? We're getting rid of that. I'm going there, I'm sure. So I don't know if you guys have a hard stop, but I've got so much more to tell you. Anyway, where are we in the middle of this? That's the sacred text. I want to say the one thing that I will say about the Tantric philosophy that informs, not to go into detail of it, but basically you give it the orientation of it. The great debate, you know what, we can just leave that. Let's leave that blue. Some of this kind of nice shadow coming on, right? Turn it back on. Dualism, so this is basically the argument is between dualism and monism. And then Tantra comes in with non-dualism. So dualism says there's good and evil, right? Straight up, a lot of the early stuff, be good, no evil, all good, right? It's very tribal. Tribe's idea of what's good. You know, be good or we'll throw you out, basically. And there's good or bad, and it's the problem is it's local, right? And, you know, I'm talking about upper and lower Neolithic things. Realize lower Neolithic had a real big bad morality problem. Because if morality is local, it's be nice. Well, who's going to be nice? Whose idea of nice? It makes it really easy to go and slaughter, you know, another neighboring tribe. They're not being nice. They don't do it our way. Big problem. And if you look at the lower Neolithic layer, it's just bloodshed. I mean, look at the way the Hawaiian Islands were. Holy crap. Just, you know, it's just bloodshed after bloodshed. It's petty just because it's so, and you know, the truth is if you're raising animals and slaughtering animals all the time, it's not that hard to make the jump to slaughtering, other human beings, too. I mean, let's just be really honest about that. So there was a morality problem. The upper Neolithic, the Osiris, came in with law and said, okay, thou shalt not. The problem is, why? Because God says so, because the king says so, and it's our rules, and there's not room for other people. And, oh, by the way, every time we have a institutionalized morality, somebody always gets scapegoated. And women, absolutely are the scapegoats of the upper Neolithic culture. Right? I don't know if you know this. Again, I'm not, lest you think I'm presenting Hinduism as this beautiful thing we ought to do. I mean, classical mainstream Hinduism says that menstruation is the mark of women's shared guilt in the murder of God. You know, how's that? You know, what a stack the deck against you ready to begin with. So that's the problem, is we have morality to keep people from killing one another, but in order to do that, we're going to say it's our way or the highway, and you've got another problem. So clearly there's a moral problem that is not solved all throughout human history, and only since 1904 do we have really an answer to that. You know, so believe me, I'm not saying we should all go back to the Aeon of Isis and be householders and farmers, but I think there's a fusion that involves a Thelemic ethic with the technology that was evolved before in the Isis world. Oh, anyway, dualism says good and evil. Monism says it's all one. It's all one. God is everything. Even evil is God. It's all, well, problem with that is, if you really did that, it's all one anyway. You can do anything you want. Reality is, most people that are monists are not saying do anything you want. Say, well, there's still good and evil, but evil is because you're believing an illusion. And that's why you're suffering. But it doesn't even exist, because there's only one thing, and that's good, and that's God, because evil doesn't exist. Because it's an illusion. It's an impure illusion. So who do you want to go with? You see, and there's still this split. There's still this non-resolution. And Tantra comes along, and these are debated, you know, by great people in court. There's these wonderful texts of these debates and people presenting these sort of, like it's a court case. And the Tantrics come in and say, bitch, please, right? It's a pulsation. There's unity, and then there's separation. And then there's unity, and then there's separation. And the drop goes into the ocean, and is lost, and is one with the ocean. And then you know what? Because we're moving forward in time, four-dimensional thinking. It's not just a picture that's good or evil, up or down, or right? There's a progression over time. We're together, we're separate, we're together, we're separate. It constantly goes with that. And one of the sort of, you know, scary things they don't say is, well, does that mean that you could be fully enlightened and then turn around and fall from grace out of your love for, you know, I gotta go help my peeps. Don't get involved with those idiots. More incarnations and more karma. Yeah, why not? You can bring on tap as much bliss as you want to counteract whatever poison you have to deal with. Then that sort of becomes a real rule. Okay, so that's basically, and there's a lot more subtlety here, but that's basically the idea between dualism, monism, and then non-dualism. Okay. Let me grab one of these handouts. I'm just going to jump through. And then, thank you. We're talking about here. So some of the things that I'm going to talk about, some of the sort of philosophical, technical models of consciousness that Tantra gets into. How are we doing for time? I'm like blowing it out here.
2:05.
Okay. Okay, so it's very much in the spirit of do certain things happen. Tantra describes particular parts of the self. And this is, again, where I want to urge you to not jump to correspondences, because there are some easy correspondences you can make. Don't jump to them quite. It's kind of like if you try to put the chakras, you ever tried to correspond the chakras to the tree of life? You go, oh, crown. Oh, yeah, okay. And then heart. Oh, that's easy, temperate. Okay. And then, you know, like, I don't know, is yes at my kidneys, or is yes at my, you know, okay. And at a certain point, this isn't going to, this looked like it was going to fall out so neatly, and now I'm in the weeds, and it's, you know, maybe this is not such a good idea. So there's a bunch of things with that about parts of the self, particularly if you know some of the Kabbalistic parts of the soul and so forth. Look similar, hold off. And then, having said that, Yeah, boy, isn't it interesting, there's some similarities. Okay, so Buddhism talks a bunch about the split between body-mind. Tantra Loka, he critiques him so brutally. He picks on Buddhists and Vishnu worshippers like, modern snotty occultist bishop picking on Christians. Basically, he's just like knocking them, he's laughing at them. Because this, people who are not smart enough to deal with how it really works and stuff, he gets funny. Buddhism talks about, I apologize in advance, because I get snarky about Buddhism too, because I really don't like it. I did a bunch of my scholarly work on Buddhism, so I have an informed reason for not caring for it. So I apologize in advance if I insult anybody's Buddhist connections and tendencies. I don't know what I'm talking about, you can laugh me off. But Buddhism talks about the split between body and mind. And Tantra says, no, it's more complicated than that. Yeah, there's the body, but there is not just the mind. There is, in fact, two minds. In fact, there are three minds. There's the body mind and the concept mind. The body mind keeps track of where your body is in space. It knows what shape your legs are and it knows if there's a chair that you're going to bump into, right? And then your concept mind knows symbols and story and meaning and so forth. And a really easy way to see this is telling a story while you're driving, right? And you're driving, you're not hitting anybody. You're maneuvering, you're avoiding the other cars, you're in no danger of hitting anybody at any time, and if something comes up, you'll steer around it. You have no trouble. And meanwhile, you're describing the Spider-Man movie, and then he did this, and she said that, and they did this. And you can be all entirely in your story. Well, same thing with walking. It's not like cars are special, although they're interesting. Exercise. Motorcycles, too. They're a bunch of motorcycle meditation. So the idea is that you've got these two minds that are working, and this is why people think they can multitask, is yeah, you can. You can do two things. One with your body mind and one with your concept. Okay? Most people have an orientation of which one is dominant. And throughout most of the history, it has been people's body minds. Back in the day, if you were a peasant, if you were building pyramids for the Egyptians and drinking beer at night, you're probably in your body mind and had about this much concept mind going on. Right? Then again, if you're a priest, huge concept stuff. Right? But it used to be that along with language, the concept mind stuff was like educated. Often I had to do with class stuff, right? At least in Assyrian roles. So you've got those two. Then you've got a third mind, which none of the other Hindu or Buddhist systems knows anything about or mentions whatsoever. And it's called the Turiya. Turiya means fourth, because there's a fourth state. Waking, dreaming, dreamless sleep, and Turiya, fourth state. It is a state of silent observation. The best description of Turiya is actually in Carlos Castaneda's books. If you guys have read Castaneda, I grew up with Castaneda and practiced those exercises, later came to life, realized that he stole a bunch of it from Dzogchen Tantra. Right? His description of Nahual is spot on for Turiya. Right? Anything you can say about it, it's not it. Anything you could do, anything you feel, anything, it's not it. It's this, it's like the you behind the curtain. And it's not the ego. See, that's another thing. There is no ego. And there's no mention of ego in Tantra whatsoever. That's a later adoption. I think, honestly, ego is kind of a scam. It's like, oh, it's not you. It's not your crappy choices and selfish decisions. You have this bad ego. It's kind of like saying, oh, you have a sweet tooth. It's not your fault. It's just your sweet tooth. And like, no, it's your crappy decisions. I mean, it's not that complicated. It's not like you've got this demon that you need to squash. No. So the part of you, the Turiya, is the I, the what enables us to assemble our point of view. But it's not the ego. It is not being egotistical. If anything, it's silent. Okay. Now, here's the other interesting thing. The Turiya mind is what develops through yogic and magical practice. And most yogic and magical practice is designed to silence the body mind and the concept mind. Why? Because you leave silence in the temple and what comes out, right? So there's this process of evolution that happens naturally that can't be induced, that happens just because you get the other two to show up and balance. And that's the development of the Turiya. The Turiya mind, then, is the avenue through which then we... I've got a great idea. Turiya mind, then, is the avenue through which we reach the other part, the fifth, fourth mind, which is Shiva, which is God. That depth comes through Turiya. Now, these parts of the self come up, and the Tantra talks about these different states of consciousness that we have, waking, dreaming, dreamless sleep, and then the fourth state, Turiya, sleep, where your minds are asleep, but your Turiya mind is awake. And in each of these, we can talk about what's awake and what's asleep, and how that makes those states of consciousness. So when you're awake, your body mind, because you know what's around you, your concept mind, because you're thinking, and your Turiya mind, because you're aware of self, and you're aware around you. When you're asleep, your body mind doesn't know where it is. And you're all lost in these dreams in your concept mind. And your Turiya mind isn't there as well. There's also a dreamless sleep in which all of your minds are completely asleep, and that's when you rest and you heal. If you don't get that, you don't heal. And then Turiya sleep is a state where you're not awake and you're not dreaming, and your minds are asleep, but your awareness of your self, true self, can happen. And if people talk about a state between dreaming and waking, that's the Turiya state. In fact, the Turiya state is the state between the other states. So as you pass from dreaming to dreamless sleep, you pass through it. But you can't just jump automatically, easily, to the Turiya state for waking. You can't just get there. This is, you know, you do meditation practice, you usually get there through it. But anyway, so that's how it models it. And then it says, all right, in addition to those states of consciousness, there's another version of each of them when you have awakened realization of your Shiva self, and now you're awake and know you're Shiva and everyone else is, or you're dreaming and you know you're Shiva and everyone else is, and so forth. So each of those states then has that additional activated awareness as well. And then it gets more detailed than that. It says there are sub-states of the states. So you can be awake, but dreaming. We call it daydreaming. When you're daydreaming, you kind of forget where your body is, lost in a little reverie, right? It's daydreaming. Okay. So there's all these sub-states of each of the states, and I won't go into in detail here, but I've listed them on there for you. So this is a very interesting analysis of states of consciousness that then you can talk about in terms of, you know, what is happening and what are, you know, stuff. And then finally here, we have classes of practice. And this is, classes of practice come up as a major topic in the text. I think partly because these are a major thing for deciding, if you've got a student, which practice is right for them, right? Because not everyone is the same. The Tantra talks about how to choose which practices are right for which people. Basically, and the way it splits down is, to begin with, are people basically in their body or in their mind? Now, where I have a cultural critique of this for myself, of the Tantra, is to say, you know, back historically, most people were in their body and only a few elite people developed their minds. So there's this assumption that the mind is this higher thing. But, I mean, a bit of a Gupta says in Tantra, look at, no, you know, they're equivalent. One is not superior to the other. And I would say in the modern world, we've got a lot of people who are very much in their mind and barely in their bodies at all. This is what our, you know, being on our phone and our computers allows us to do. It allows us to be in the concept mind. You know, and our body mind only has to know how to, you know, make sure we have batteries in control. So there's that. So there's basically four classes of practice. And they talk about what they are, and then he goes on in Tantra Loka to talk about whose system falls into what categories. Which is pretty cool, right? So the four classes are basically Anavapaya, which is body supported. You're using body methods like chanting, right, to as a means of silencing and controlling your body. If you're completely in your body, let's give your body something to do so then it can be quiet. Okay. Likewise, Saktapaya is using the mind, the concept mind, to still the concept mind. So, okay, so you're going to do ritual. You know, so you're going to recite these texts, so you're going to do these ritual actions, or you're going to visualize these symbols, or you're going to, you know, these various things. And the idea is to get control of and to effectively, in most cases, silence for a while, the concept. The profound practices lead through both of those. At a certain point, when you've been doing this enough, and this is what I discovered from 20-plus years of practice, at a certain point, you can do that very quickly. Your meditation practice becomes, you're able to silence your body, mind, and your concept mind pretty much as quickly as you can make your body stop moving. Right? So that those things are immediately accessible. Right? Then you get into a third state called sambhavapaya, which is unsupported practices, because they aren't using the body mind, or they aren't using the concept mind. It's not symbolic, and it's not practices, but, oh my God, the mountain. And you go. You're already able to stop your body mind and your concept mind, so that when you turn around and you see that beautiful mountain in the distance, and you feel that expansiveness, you are not intending to do it, you're allowing. You're letting yourself fall into that ocean of consciousness, knowing perfectly well that, you know what, pendulum will swim back again, you're going to come back. There's no fear of dissolving, because, hey, you know what, every time you dissolve, you keep coming back, and you know what, so it seems like that's what's going to happen. So sambhavapaya becomes this third state of practice where it takes very, very little effort or intention to do the practice, but the practice then becomes something that you're basically doing all the time. And there was a certain point when I realized in my own practice that I was not only doing it when I did it, but it was also coming back. But it actually didn't stop. It's still going on. It's a little bit, in ceremonial magic terms, it's a little bit like saying, if you open the temple enough times, eventually the temple just stays open, if you want it to. It just stays open, and you're doing ritual all the time. And just by being there, just by... You don't even have to, oh God, it's just there for you automatically, just through repetition, and it's the same equivalent kind of thing. Now, having said that, I would say, we were talking about terminology in one of the groups last night, I wouldn't call that illuminated, certainly not enlightened, but I would call it awakened. When you realize that it's going on all the time, you don't have to make an effort for it, it's there for you all the time. Curiously, my experience with the practice became, and there's nothing sexual about my practice, it's a meditation practice, it's all in my head, right? I'm not even in a visualization, it's just, sex is good, it's another thing. But meditation practice, my relationship to it became like a relationship with a lover. Like at first, you have to make a date and show up and spend some time together, be really polite, make sure you don't forget, make a habit out of it, make sure, and eventually, you're just kind of there all the time, and eventually, you're spending so much of your time together, it's like you could be in the midst of your work, it's like, oh, hi, hon, got time for a smooch, nice, and then you're back at your work again. Or, well, I can't do it, well, let me check, I'll be there later, right? And that this presence of a loved one is very much like what it becomes with meditation. It's not intrusive, it's just like driving. If something comes up, you drive. Hey, when I got to do my income tax, I'm not probably dissolving into an ocean of bliss at the moment that I'm writing those numbers. I'll probably pause till I get done with the numbers and go, oh, thank heavens, and then, So that's what goes on. That's the third state. The fourth state is called anapaya. It means no practice. You do nothing. At that point, you're so completely rooted in your realization that nothing whatsoever will distract you. And this gets to an interesting idea of the way Tantra models the goal of enlightenment, not as you'll reach samadhi and then everything will be fine, because we now know that actually that's not true. There's that, then the work just starts to begin. And oh, by the way, according to the text, you reach samadhi naturally every 20 or 30 seconds, but you forget, which is an interesting concept. Some of the most powerful tools don't take you deeply within, they catch you on the way back out and say, don't forget. I was Shiva there for a second. I'm just gonna kind of remember I'm a Shiva, because otherwise it's like having a great dream and then the dream dissolves. Right? Just like the blind spot in your eye, like you can your eye fuses. By the blind spot, your eye tricks you to say, oh, there's no blind spot. It's just normal. But if you actually look, no, there's a spot there. There's a blind spot in our awareness that says, every 20 or 30 seconds we go into a full samadhi experience, and then return back out of it and forget it completely. So a bunch of the practices work with that natural flow, and that's why they're so powerful. Let's see, where are we at here? Yeah. We'll take a brief break to stretch in something. Is now a good time for that?
Sure.
Which means it's actually cold.
Oh, you're warm.
Here, I have the woolly